have successfully partnered with Metro on several projects in our district, including at Grant Butte and Adaka, and we are looking forward to continuing that work in the future. We're here today to request that we potentially deepen our collaboration and partnership into the future. Specifically, we are requesting that Metro help support the work of the district and others to ensure a sustainable future for agriculture here in the Metro area by making at least $10 million available in the proposed open space bond to support the protection of working farmland properties. If Metro positioned this funding as a grant program, the district would be happy to take the lead on all aspects of those transactions, including management of those property interests in perpetuity. Ensuring a future for sustainably managed agriculture is critical to our regional quality of life. Sustainably managed agriculture results in clean air, water and soil, local food, iconic landscapes, and jobs. Addressing these issues is critical at this point in time. In Multnomah County, 50,000 acres of farmland has been lost to other uses since 1945, and 60% of farmland is expected to change hands in the next 20 years. And we have some of the highest agricultural land values anywhere in the state and in the country. So land use regulations, they have helped slow the loss of farmland, but they haven't stopped it. And they cannot touch on several important things that are a real challenge to agriculture. So that includes sustainable management of agricultural lands. That includes access to farmland for new and disadvantaged farmers. And that includes, that includes making sure that farmland remains in production and doesn't become fallow. We think that there's opportunities for meaningful interventions in these areas that would result in better outcomes. Stakeholder representation from the agriculture community has not been extremely robust in the current open space bond, but there was an outreach effort in 2018 that did result in support from the agriculture community to have Metro support farmland protection efforts. And critically, we think there's also an exciting opportunity to leverage Metro funds with the hopefully soon-to-be-funded Oregon Agricultural Heritage Program. That's a $10 million state effort that would provide funds at the state level that could leverage local funding efforts. So thank you for taking the time to hear me today, and we hope that Metro can help us partner with us on this important work.
Thank you, and good timing.
That's what I thought, absolutely perfect.
Ms. Nassett.
Thank you, Councillor, and good day, Council members. Last week when I was here, I was talking about the environmental impact statement for the Rose Quarter for I-84. And I was talking about there were several opportunities for non-build that have not been looked at. And I had some people who actually asked me what I meant by that. And here is a small portion. The Moda Center has 20,000 seats, so just under 20,000 seats. It doesn't include all the people that work there, put up the stage, bring in the food, all that other kind of stuff. So when you have an event place that's 20,000, you have the memorial, the Veteran Coliseum, 12,000, and then you have the Oregon Convention Center at 15,000. But we don't have in place an event drop-off plan. I'll give you an idea. When the Moda Center went in, we wanted to have buses that came from out in the communities, perhaps bars or wherever. People were interested in the sports. They came with their family on buses. The buses dropped off and then left. Okay? If 20% of that 20,000, that's 4,000 vehicles. I know they're not each driving one. But that's 4,000 vehicles going there and 4,000 vehicles coming back. And they would drop off there. People would hang out. And it would not ruin the economy in our area because you can't find a parking spot. When Paul Allen put that addition to the Coliseum in, he made a stipulation, because his garages were to be full, no dropping off for events. Not from Salem, not from Seattle, not from Woodburn, not from the community, none. It is inappropriate. So now the Oregon Convention Center stayed basically with the same policy. You have a ceramics thing. They could go out into the community, pick up ceramics, meet people, say, hey, I love your product. Go out of state, because many of them come in from out of state, buy that product, money coming in from out of state, less congestion. The other thing was hotels downtown are not allowed to have shuttle services back and forth to the airport. 10 people come into the airport, say the Hilton. 10 people come in hourly, 10 people go out, just to the airport between 6 a.m. and 10 o'clock. That's 200 cars. And they could have a shuttle going out and dropping off within 2 to 10 miles, like all the other ones that are on the east side of the freeway are allowed to do. And we have a dozen hotels. So
thank you.
There's about 8 of those policies. I know I'm over time. Fred Hansen and I, he was the one that said, well, you can't do this for this, the medallions, the taxes. But all that's changed with Uber.
Thank you. Thank you.
Grazie.
Mr. Ormsby.
Yes. My name is Charles Ormsby. I go by Skip. I'm co-chair of the Birds Hill CPONA. This is the northeast quadrant of Lake Oswego. I need immediate assistance with the intersection in the city of Lake Oswego at Oregon Highway 43, mile point 6.04. This is the intersection of State Street, a.k.a. Highway 43, at B Avenue. TriMet buses for 42 years come this June have had schedules going through that intersection. It is exceptionally tight. City of Lake Oswego owns the northwest corner of that intersection. They have done nothing in a plan that was just reviewed in the Lake Oswego Review pamphlet papers. In 8 weeks, they're going to essentially solidify that intersection's geometry for another 50 years minimum. It needs to be changed now. I've asked for help from the Metro Council as of about 8 weeks ago. I've received nothing. I'm in the process of filing complaints with the FHWA, and whoever it takes to get somebody to act to get TriMet buses through that intersection in an effective manner, not only the 40-foot standard buses, but the anticipated 60-foot electric articulated. Action needs to be taken now. ODOT had a letter to Lake Oswego 2017, December 7th, Thursday. They've done nothing to include, through 4 iterations of plans, they have done nothing to change the geometry of that intersection. Transit-dependent riders are not being serviced by the city of Lake Oswego. They are not. People with handicapped disabilities are anticipated to, in the future, walk an extra quarter mile from the existing transit center to the east side of State Street. State Street is what I'm calling, politely, a pedestrian kill zone. In the last 6 months, I've been accosted twice by vehicles when I've attempted to cross at various locations. This is getting serious. Lake Oswego does not give a rip for pedestrians. Ask about the six-way intersection debacle, taking out stop signs for transit walkers to get access to transit. People need to get in the wheelchairs. They need to push people in wheelchairs. They need to understand the limitations of people with Americans with disabilities, and they need to understand it now. There's no coordination between TriMet, Metro, Clackamas County, the Transit ATU 757, to my personal satisfaction. This is insane. I've been here twice. I'm anticipating having to go down to Salem. I'm not a happy camper on this issue. I have to leave my mother or get help to care for her. She's bedbound, age 104.6. We've lived in this area since 1952 when there's angled parking on it. Traffic is a serious situation in the Lake Oswego Special Transportation Area. When a person like me carrying a 40-pound pack can pass traffic for a half mile, it's congested. You're anticipating to put high-density housing out in Stafford area. You've got problems that coming out the woodwork. I need help immediately. How do I get it?
Thank you, Mr. Ormsby. As a reminder, this is not a place for deliberation, but we appreciate you sharing your perspective and receiving your input.
Okay, please. I've tried to contact the council. My calls are not being returned. Where do I file a complaint?
You can continue to testify. Thank you. Is there anybody else that would like to testify? Seeing none, we now close the public communication. Today's consent agenda consists of 3 items: the minutes for the April 4, 2019 council meeting, resolution number 19-4980, and resolution number 19-4986. Is there a motion for approval?
Move approval.
Second.
Moved by Councilor Craddock and seconded by Councilor Lewis. All in favor, say aye.
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 All opposed, say nay. Consent agenda is approved. We now move to ordinances, first read and public hearing. First is ordinance number 19-1436. For the purpose of annexing to the metro boundary approximately 21.57 acres located at 4091 Northeast Constable Street and approximately 12.1 acres located west of Northeast Star Boulevard and south of Northeast Huffman Road in Hillsborough, which I think is also known as the illustrious District 2.
Four. It's still illustrious.
We now move to a hearing on proposed ordinance number 19-1436 regarding a request by Flexential Colorado Corp. and T5 Data Centers to annex to the Metro District boundary approximately 21.57 acres located at 4091 Northeast Constable Street, approximately 12.1 acres located west of Northeast Star Boulevard and south of Northeast Huffman Road in Hillsborough. As part of a quasi-judicial hearing, I need to state the following, and I appreciate the folks being patient with the repetition, but we have to make sure that we are following our procedures. The members of the council here today are myself, Deputy Council President Sam Chase, and Councilors Shirley Craddock, Christine Lewis, Craig Dirksen, and Juan Carlos Gonzalez. Because this is a quasi-judicial land use hearing, council members must declare a conflict of interest or ex parte contact prior to the staff presentation. If a councilor has a conflict of interest, they are not allowed to participate in the council discussion or vote on that application. If a councilor has had an ex parte contact, they must declare the substance of it on the record, and it is subject to rebuttal. Discussions with Metro staff are not considered ex parte contacts. Councilors will be asked to declare any conflict of interest or an ex parte contact after the Metro attorney describes additional procedural requirements. I now call on Acting Metro Attorney Nathan Sykes to read the procedural requirements.
Thank you, Deputy Council President Chase. For quasi-judicial hearings of this type, Oregon land use statutes require that I provide the following statement of certain required procedures. Under Section 3.09.07 of the Metro Code, this type of annexation into the Metro District boundary must be initiated by petition, which must be reviewed and acted on by the Council following a public hearing. Public testimony at this hearing should only address the applicable approval criteria. The applicable approval criteria are set forth in Section 3.09070 of the Metro Code and are more specifically identified in the staff report, which is part of the packet of materials before the Council. The decision of the Council is final, although it can be challenged by filing a notice of intent to appeal with the Land Use Board of Appeals within 21 days of the final decision. If any person fails to raise an issue in person during the hearing or by letter or fails to provide sufficient evidence to allow the council to respond to an issue, that issue may not be the basis for an appeal to LUBA. Failure of the applicant to raise constitutional or other issues relating to proposed conditions of approval with sufficient specificity to give the council an opportunity to respond to the issues precludes an action for damages in the circuit court under ORS 197.796. The hearing procedures are as follows. First, Metro staff will present a short report. The staff report will describe the proposal, identify the applicable approval criteria, and summarize the staff recommendation. The applicant may then make a presentation in support of their application. Following the applicant's presentation, other persons in support of the application will be given the opportunity to speak. Opponents of the application, if any, will have the opportunity to speak. The applicant may then rebut any testimony from opponents. Public testimony will be closed. After the record is closed to all parties, council members may then discuss and vote on the request. This hearing is part of the official record. In your testimony, please speak specifically about this application and how the criteria relate to the request. Please submit a copy of any testimony, and that will be maintained as part of the record. Now back to you, Deputy Council President Chase.
The case being reviewed is proposed ordinance number 19-1436 regarding a request by Flexential Colorado Corp. and T5 Data Centers to annex to the Metro District boundary approximately 21.57 acres located at 4091 Northeast Constable Street, and approximately 12.1 acres located west of Northeast Star Boulevard and south of Northeast Huffman Road in Hillsborough. Do any council members have ex parte contacts to disclose?
Can I have a question? For my lack of judicial knowledge, can you describe what ex parte contact is?
Contact directly with one of the parties involved in the application.
Can't say I have.
Do any council members have a conflict of interest to declare?
No.
I now ask Tim O'Brien, Metro staff, for a brief presentation.
Good afternoon, Deputy Council President Chase, councilors, Tim O'Brien, Metro Planning Department staff. As you've heard a couple times already, before you today is an annexation to the Metro District boundary for two parcels that total approximately 33.67 acres in North Hillsborough. Both parcels are part of the Evergreen Area Industrial Plan that Hillsborough completed, consistent with Metro's Title 11 requirements for planning new urban areas. The Evergreen Area Industrial Plan was incorporated into the larger North Hillsborough Industrial Area Plan District. The land must be annexed to the Metro District boundary for urbanization to occur. Both properties were recently annexed into the City of Hillsborough. Once all the annexations are complete, building may occur consistent with the approved plan. The criteria for annexation of land into the Metro boundary are in Metro Code Section 3.09.070E. The criteria include: 1, that the affected territory lies within the urban growth boundary. 2, the territory is subject to measures that prevent urbanization until the territory is annexed to a city or to service districts that will provide the necessary urban services. And 3, the proposed change is consistent with any applicable cooperative or urban service agreements adopted pursuant to ORS Chapter 195 and any concept plan. As outlined in the staff report, the application does meet the requirement for annexation to the Metro boundary. The properties were included in the urban growth boundary in 2005 through the adoption of Metro Ordinance 05-1070A. Washington County applied the future development 20 acres designation to all the land included in that ordinance to prevent urbanization of the expansion area prior to the completion of the comprehensive planning of the area and annexation to the City of Hillsborough. As noted, the subject land was recently annexed to the city. Thus, the area was subject to measures that prevented urbanization until the territory is annexed to a city or service districts. And then finally, 3, annexation of land is consistent with the Hillsborough's Evergreen Area Industrial Plan and North Hillsborough Industrial Area Plan District, as well as the Urban Planning Area Agreement between Washington County and Hillsborough that was adopted in 2017. Thus, the inclusion of the land in the Metro District is consistent with all applicable plans and agreements. Therefore, staff does recommend approval of Ordinance 19-1436, and I'm certainly available for any questions if you have any. Thank you.
Councilor Dirksen.
I have a question. We have two petitioners and two parcels. Is each petitioner petitioning for one parcel, or are both petitioners petitioning for both parcels?
Councilor Dirksen, councilors, each petitioner is petitioning for one parcel. There was two applications submittal. Rather than bringing you two separate ordinances, I combined them into one.
Thank you.
Councilor Craddock.
Yeah, I have a question.
Go ahead.
Go ahead, Councilor Craddock, and then we'll
Go to come. I just want to make sure I'm looking at the map, make sure I'm reading it correctly. So obviously the top is north, and I know where Evergreen Boulevard is. Or Evergreen Road. So this is land that is south of Highway 26. Is that correct?
Councilor Craddock, yes, this is correct.
So it's between Evergreen and Highway 26.
Yes.
So then you see in the right-hand corner that parcel that's not in the urban growth boundary. So how much land is north of here that is... I probably should have looked at an urban rural reserve map. I'm trying to visualize how this look is part of the larger picture.
Sure, Councilor Craddock. The little... corner that you see that's outside the urban growth boundary is a very small amount of land that's right at the Highway 26 Chute Road interchange. So it's a very small area of rural residential uses currently right there. On the north side of Highway 26, it is rural reserve land directly north of this.
Okay.
Thank you. Just want to kind of get the bigger picture here. Thank you.
I did have a question. In terms of just the UGB map in general, were these plots of land, these parcels, were they essentially, holes in terms of the map, and we're adding them back as in non-urbanized islands? Because I see the blue line on the top right corner is our urban growth boundary, and I'm assuming everything inside of that is inside the urban growth boundary, but these parcels, we're annexing them into the metro district boundary. So they're already inside the urban growth boundary. However, what's the distinction there?
Councilor Gonzalez, yes, you're correct. They are inside the urban growth boundary. When these were brought into the urban growth boundary in 2005, there was, at that point in time, there was kind of a double process involved. We brought land to the urban growth boundary, and then it was also needed to be annexed to the metro district boundary if it was not already in that. The metro district boundary is a separate boundary from the urban growth boundary. It was actually set by the legislature, so it's got a different boundary to it. There's some land that was in the metro boundary that's not in the urban growth boundary. So now we're just playing catch-up, if you will, for these areas here. As the land gets annexed to the city to develop, we will have them annexed to the metro boundary.
That makes sense.
Yes,
that makes sense.
And just to clarify, so now that when we bring in land into the urban growth boundary now, the laws have changed, that land is automatically become part of the metro boundary.
Yes, Councilor Kredic, as of 2009, any addition that's to the urban growth boundary after that will automatically be brought into the metro boundary if needed, such as your decision you made in December, that land is automatically brought into the metro boundary.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I do have a question, and this is maybe beyond sufficient specificity in terms of the question, and maybe something for follow-up later. But in terms of the industrial area plan for this area and the value of these industrial lands to our region is very important. Mm-hmm. And I see the two proposals. I'm interested in how they fit in. And I know with data centers, as an example, I'm interested in terms of how do they fit in terms of job creation, job numbers, and support for tax base. So how are they fitting in terms of a plan's job creation and tax base creation? And I know that's very specific.
Yeah, it's Deputy Council President Chase, yes, that is quite specific. I do know that this is the North Hillsborough Industrial Area District. They have, it's quite a large district that extends basically from Jackson East all the way over to Chute Road area. They have different industrial zones throughout this district. I know there's in some locations where data centers are an allowed primary use, in other locations they are not. Data centers themselves do not employ a lot of people, but they also are important for a lot of other employment uses that do employ a lot of people.
Yes.
That's about as much as I could actually probably address to it. I can certainly follow up more with you if you prefer.
Okay, and do we know what activity is happening in the Flexential Colorado Corp property?
I believe that is the data center as well.
Also.
I believe so.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, we are not done here. We have the public hearing.
Mr. President, one more question.
Oh, excuse me. Yes.
So I see through the map that we are creating kind of two box islands between what we're annexing in and our edge. Are we engaged with the owners of those tax lots to talk to them about other application to bring in for consistency, or is that not an engagement that we proactively take?
Councilor Lewis, that's not something that we usually proactively take. Once they annex to the city of Hillsborough, as part of the requirement for their land use action there, they're required to annex to the metro district boundary, and either I notice that's happening or the city has been very proactive in letting them know that as well. So once, if either of those two properties were to develop, they would annex to the district at that point in time.
Thank you.
Okay. I will now open a public hearing. I will call, if there's anybody that would like to testify, I have no blue cards. Nevertheless, if there's anybody that would like to testify, please come forward now. Seeing no public comment, we'll move on to presentation. I will close the public hearing. And are there any other comments or discussion? Seeing none, second reading, council consideration, and vote are scheduled for Thursday, April 25th. Thank you. We now move on to ordinances second reading. First is ordinance number 19-1434. For the purpose of approving an increased tonnage allocation and authorizing the chief operating officer to issue an amended soil waste facility franchise for GSS Transfer, LLC. First reading and public hearing for ordinance number 19-1434 took place on Thursday, April 4th, 2019. I now call for a motion.
Move approval.
I'll second.
Moved by Councilor Dirksen and seconded by Councilor Craddock. I will now ask Roy Brower and Hyla Ritter to be available for questions. Are there any questions for staff?
Nope.
Hearing no questions, I will now call on the clerk to call roll.
Yes.
Aye. Councilor Dirksen.
Yes.
Councilor Gonzalez.
Aye.
Councilor Craddock.
Aye.
Deputy Council President Chase.
Aye. The ordinance is approved. We now move on to resolutions. Proposed FY 2019-20 budget presentation. I will ask Metro's Chief Operating Officer Martha Bennett, in her capacity as Metro's Budget Officer, to present the proposed budget and budget messages to the Metro Council, sitting as the Budget Committee. Martha will also be, I don't need to gavel us in as the Budget Committee.
No, you don't.
Or out or in.
No, okay. You are the Budget Committee right now. So.
Okay. And Martha will also be joined by Metro Auditor Brian Evans and...
Auditor Evans is out of town, so I think he sent you all an email. But okay. I do have Tim with me.
Okay. And we have Director Tim Collier.
All right.
Short timer.
So, I always characterize the adoption of the budget as a three-act play, and we are at the end of the first act. And up until now, councilors have been involved in the first act, but sort of offstage. And so now you move from offstage to onstage, and Tim and I very gracefully move to the sort of the wings there to support you. So, today, Tim and I are going to cover... first of all, the budget process overall, because in Multnomah County House jurisdictions, the budget process is a little different than it is in the rest of Oregon, so I want to just do a high-level overview of what happens. Then I'll deliver what I consider to be the content part of the budget message, and then I'll turn it over to Tim. He'll talk about the money. And then we will talk briefly about the Metro Auditor's budget, because as you know, under our charter and code, the Metro Auditor submits the budget to me for inclusion, but we faithfully transmit his submittal to all of you for consideration. Then I'll talk a little bit about the process going forward. Every time you see the budget up until the point you adopt it, it is scheduled as a public hearing. We sometimes have folks who do want to testify on the budget, sometimes we don't. But you'll probably notice as the budget comes before you that every time you see it, it's scheduled as a public hearing. All right, it's clear as we're going to go? Okay, so here we are. So when I tell you that it's a three-act play, we are coming to the end of the first act. And the first act really is the development of the proposed budget. So under Oregon budget law, the budget officer is required to deliver to the budget committee a proposed budget that balances. And so that's what we have done to do is we've transmitted to you today the budget developed by a whole load of staff and departments in a way that's balanced, and what we recommend for you as your spending plan, and many of you have heard me say before that the budget is really your spending plan to affect your policy agenda. So we are transmitting our proposal for your spending plan to you today.
Then we move into the second act, and the second act is your consideration of the proposed budget, and you will go in the next 3 weeks from a proposed budget to an approved budget. Now, in the rest of Oregon, that's done by a citizens' budget committee, which is the elected officials of the jurisdiction plus an equal number of citizen representatives. But because we're under the jurisdiction of the Tax Supervising and Conservation Commission, I think I finally got that right after 7 years, we actually conduct our hearing jointly with the TSCC. So the council actually sits also as a budget committee. So you will approve the budget in May. The effect of the approval is that, first of all, you set the maximum property tax levy. So the most important of the actions that you'll take when you approve the budget is you will say this is the maximum amount that Metro can levy in property taxes. You will also set the total appropriation levels for our major funds, but as we move into the adoption phase, you can still change the amount of those appropriation levels. You can always lower them. Nothing in Oregon budget law prevents you from lowering approved appropriations, and you can only increase them by 10% over the approved amounts. Now, Tim and I will talk to you about that. It's really, because of the size of Metro's fund levels, it's really never been a problem for Metro, because our fund levels are generally sufficient to allow the council a lot of discretion within that 10% amount. And then you will submit, it allows us to submit our budget as you've approved it to the TSCC for their consideration. Then during the rest of that act, we move into the third act, the TSCC will conduct a review of that, they'll hold a hearing with all of you in early June, and we'll work with you on any amendments that you as councilors think that you want to offer to the budget as we move towards the actual adopted budget. The one thing Tim and I will tell you is the budget actually has to be adopted by midnight on June 30th, or else we can't spend money at 12:01 a.m. on July 1st. And so we always schedule the budget adoption phase to take place usually in the second or third week in June, just in case any hiccups come along and we need the last couple weeks in June to make sure we can address those hiccups. It's never happened in my time at Metro, but that you'll see that you're scheduled for budget adoption on June 20th, well ahead of June 30th. Okay, questions about the actually, what I'm going to suggest is hold your questions to the end, because if I start on questions, we'll go down a lot of different places. Okay. So in proposing the budget, and as I told you, the budget is a spending plan to execute the council's policy agenda. I generally have four sort of things in mind. First of all, how do I make sure I propose to you a spending plan that allows you to continue the high-quality public services that the public has come to expect? Many of you have heard me say before that one of my major goals in preparing the budget is to make sure that Metro is reliable in the eyes of the folks who live and work here. That's one of the ways, one of the really important ways we build trust with the public is to be dependable. That means no big radical swings in how we deliver services, but rather planning and thought that goes into how we make service adjustments. The second thing is we have put a strong diversity, equity, and inclusion lens on the spending in the budget. I'll talk about this more later as I talk about where that shows up. The third thing is we know, and I think we've talked with all of you in the council in advance, that there are things that confront us in all of our operating funds that are sort of structural in nature in terms of challenges that make it hard to do that first thing, which I just said, which is to make sure that we're very reliable in the delivery of services. And the last thing I really focus on developing this planning plan is making sure we're taking care of the assets that the people of the region have put in our trust to take care of. So we make investments to make sure we're taking care of what we have. So how do we do this? First, I think we take a lot of direction from you. I think many of you know that we start in the fall with an early council conversation, first about what we're seeing financially in terms of the trends, but also checking in with the policy agenda that you've created. Many of you also know that we work very hard to make sure the council feels pretty good around the budget as proposed, so that as you're making adjustments, it's simply to make sure that things that have come up since the time we first started planning in November or in January, such as important initiatives you want to undertake, can be funded, rather than major overhauls of spending decisions that we've proposed. The next thing we look at is we have some internal operational goals, which I should have included this year because I know I have three new elected officials who haven't seen them until they're ready to tell me to stop saying them. We have some internal operational goals related to people, processes, and our capital assets that we also implement through this budget, a lot of them related to human resources, a lot of them around IT infrastructure and how we use it, a lot of it around data and performance measurement, and then some goals around how we do capital planning. Those we make sure get incorporated in every department's budget. And then last but not least, I filter anything in terms of an ad package or adjustment against the council's articulated 6 desired regional outcomes. It's not a perfect tool, but it's the best tool we have, really, to talk about what are we trying to accomplish, what are the outcomes we're seeking through our decisions about our spending plan. All right. So this is the budget, biggest budget in Metro's history. I can't even say that. I just stumbled over it. Tim will talk about why that is. Because we're selling the housing bonds. I think the council's known that. So for me, the most important numbers in this chart isn't the bottom line, although it's big. I never thought I would ever get to do a billion-dollar budget. I feel like Austin Powers when I say that.
That's evil.
That's him. The two numbers I really look at when I look at this budget are the operating funds number. You'll see we basically have a flat budget from last year in terms of the proposed budget. Tim will go into this a little bit more. Our personnel costs are up, but our materials and services costs are slightly down, which is what allows us to have a relatively flat operating budget. And then I look at the bottom number, the full-time equivalent number. So we have, you'll see in this budget, proposed some substantial increases in personnel in the budget. Some of this is the conversion of folks who were temporaries or part-time folks or outsourced into a regular full-time status. And in some cases, what we're doing is we're taking existing programs that have been staffed at part-time or seasonal, and we're converting them to full-time regular status employees. And we can get into that more if you'd like to as we talk through the budget. I do want to make sure that I talk very specifically about what you all told me that you wanted the budget to deliver and sort of where does it show up. And I won't have the numbers memorized, so go ahead and ask your questions, and we'll make sure that if I don't know the answers right off the top of my head that we come back to you with them. The first thing that you told me you wanted to make sure we do is deliver on the regional investment strategy. And I would tell you that the budget contains funding to, first of all, do the first year's implementation of the housing bond, which passed in November of 2018. And I think you all know that there are, because you added them in January, that's why I think you know that, that we added the people and some of the administrative costs that are necessary to actually deliver that budget in the planning department's budget in January. And this budget fully funds those things. The second is we anticipate that you will refer a Parks and Nature bond measure in June for consideration in November of 2019. And there's staffing, there's funding in the budget, not for the work on the measure, because that will largely be complete, but for the work that would be needed to make sure that all the administrative details are put in place in anticipation that that bond measure might pass in November. And then last but not least, there's a substantial amount of funds that you've set aside in the past for the T2020 consideration and making sure we can advance a regional transportation funding measure in November of 2020. The second thing you told me, and this is based on what you told me to what you passed in your urban growth management decision back in November of 2018, is that you wanted to make sure that we addressed the issues that came up in the urban growth report around where are we going with employment in our region, you know, what's happening with the economy, and how does that, what's happening with the economy, affect how we plan for employment lands. You guys just asked Tim O'Brien some questions that I think are very much about what employment in 2019 looks like compared to when the regional functional plan was adopted in the mid-1990s. You'll see substantial funding and some of the increases in FTE in the budget for implementation of the regional waste plan that you recently adopted. I think you know that there's some major transformative work anticipated as part of that regional waste plan, and that will require us to make sure we have staff. You also will see an increase in the budget for the innovation and investment grants at your direction, because we want to make sure we're thinking about what's happening in the market for things like plastics or paper, and how can we actually encourage innovation in the private market so that we develop our own commodities markets as opposed to relying on foreign markets. You told me that you wanted an effort around how do we take our climate action work and our disaster preparedness work and think about regional resiliency. So even when we put, if this has changed even since we put this slide together, you will see staffing for a regional resiliency planner in the office of the COO and also funding to support a project to figure out what that is. And then last but not least, you told us that you wanted Metro to increase, to become an employer of choice. And you'll see that we've put funding in the budget to address some very short-term things, like making sure we offer paid parental leave, and also to allow us to implement things like the pay equity law and making sure that all of our employees are paid fairly for the work that they actually do and that equal work is paid equally. All right. The next thing that's been a major agenda for council has been making sure that we are following through on the commitments we made in the 2016 strategic plan to advance racial equity, diversity, and inclusion. You will see funding for the next steps on the C2P2 project, including conversion of the position that had been seen as limited duration for that project into a regular status full-time equivalent position. We know, based on the work we've done so far, that if Metro wants to actually see that work come to fruition, that's the work we're going to be in the long haul, not for just the duration of the project. You will see implementation of the equity action plans that planning and development, parks and nature, property and environmental services, and the Oregon Zoo adopted during the last year. This shows up in terms of staffing, particularly in parks, but also in the zoo, I believe. You'll see the support for funding for equity-specific planning in the remainder of Metro's departments, OCC, Portland's five Centers for the Arts, the Portland Expo Center, and also our internal services departments. And you'll see continued funding, and we'll talk about this more on Tuesday on your work session, for the Community Partnerships Pilot Project, which is really how can we go deeper in our relationships with many of the organizations that represent people of color, and how can we grow the capacity of those folks to engage with Metro and also with our local government stakeholders. Also on DEI, here at the Metro Regional Center and also in our Parks Department, we completed ADA assessments last year, and so you'll see funding to actually implement many of those assessments, because it's not good enough just to know what you need to do. You got to actually have to put your money where your mouth is and actually deliver capital projects. You'll see a lot of work being done in human resources to improve their ability to recruit and retain people of color and other historically underrepresented groups here at Metro. And you'll see work inside of finance and regulatory services to increase participation with COBID certified firms. All right. This is the part that gets me really excited, but usually not so exciting for counselors. You'll also see one of the things that I think the Metro has done really well over the years is that we take the opportunity to make sure not only do we take care of what we have, but when we do have some one-time funds, we try to invest them in one-time things that help us lower our operating costs. So you're going to see some substantial infrastructure investments, both in technology and also in buildings and physical assets. So if you don't mind, I'm just going to mention a few of the tech improvements. You will see we're going to upgrade all of our websites. Although those of us who've been around for a while, it feels like we just did it. It actually was like 6 years ago, and there's been major transformative changes in terms of how people use websites in those 6 years. And so we're going to be updating our websites, and you'll see budget investments in communications, IT, or IS, and also through many of our departments to do that. We'll be continuing our efforts to automate particular case management software in human resources, and also providing support for our new voice over internet protocol phone system. We're going to expand our use of paperless agendas, much to my sadness, but it does meet our sustainability goals. We'll be in a process to automate our public records requests, and we are going to be investing in redundant power for all of our servers. Right now, our servers are over in OCC, and they actually have only one power feed. And so, of course, if there's a power outage on that side of the building, then we're in, the technical term I think is deep doo-doo, for use of our technology assets. So we're going to be building a redundant power supply from the other side of OCC to make sure in the event of a power outage we can continue to do things like pay our bills. Okay, on the physical asset sides, you will see continued investments. Those of you who have been around for a while know that we have made a substantial investment in improving our ability to do capital maintenance. and capital asset management and capital project planning over the last 8 years. And so you'll see in the, particularly in the Office of the Deputy Chief Operating Officer, investments to expand that program to implement our asset management strategies. So that will show up both in terms of some people and also in terms of some M&S. We will be moving into the final phase of the 2008 zoo bond. We'll be finishing polar pathogen primates during the upcoming budget year, completing the renovation of the OCC's ballroom and entryway, hopefully building the orchestra shell, although this will be spread over a couple fiscal years at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall. You'll see improvements to Metro Central and Metro South. Also, some early planning for new solid waste facilities, possibly one on the west side. You'll see investments in park projects, and you'll see some investments here at the Metro Regional Center. Last year, I think you know, we sold some was it full faith and credit debt to make improvements to this building, because right now we're actually out of space. Not only do we have to make some ADA upgrades, but we need to make sure that as Metro continues to have new folks join us, that we have places for them to work, and also that we do our work in a way that now people do it in the 21st century as opposed to when this building was built 25 years ago. Okay, so that's what the budget, from my perspective, delivers. Now Tim is going to talk about the money part.
All right. Thank you, Martha. So as Martha mentioned, this budget, the 1920 budget, is $1.349 billion. I was talking to Lisa Houghton today and telling her how excited Kathy Rakowski, the former budget coordinator, was when we hit $500 million, so we have blown right past that. The current revenues, which are made up of all revenues excluding beginning fund balances and transfers, are $292 million. Current expenditures, all expenditures less ending fund balance transfers and contingency, is $688 million. You will notice that there's a large difference between those two. And what that is we spend down the beginning fund balances. For example, when we sell the affordable housing bond, this current year that will go into a beginning fund balance, it will be spent down in the 1920 time period. The wages and benefits are an increase of about 7%. And our full-time positions, we're asking for about 25.25 FTE in this budget.
Ooh, that's small.
So, yes, it is a little small, isn't it? So, this is the breakdown by fund. As Martha mentioned earlier, there's virtually zero growth in the operating funds, and that is really, if you'll look, you'll see the MERC fund is down by about $15 million, and that's really due to the completion of the renovation of the OCC, and then also spend down the beginning fund balances in the local option levy. You'll also notice in the bond and capital funds that is down, and that is really spending down for the last 3 years, basically, of the natural areas bond and the zoo infrastructure bond. So, and then when you get to the other, when you go down to the bottom there, you will see the other funds. The reason that the Affordable Housing Fund is not in a bond or capital fund is due to that it is actually a special revenue fund because we're passing all those those monies out. But that has included in it roughly $400 million of ending fund balance and plus the large M&S fund. Well, I have never done a $1.3 billion budget before. I don't believe I've ever seen a 3,369% growth in any single category before either. So that is new. Again, total 97% increase. So the basic breakdown on our expenses, you'll notice that the material and services is significantly larger than the other three categories we have up there. And the big reason for that is because of the contracts. For example, solid waste operations contracts, our Aramark contracts, and then we have a large amount in the materials and services for the housing bond. And then the remainder is made up, of course, capital outlay, debt service, and personnel services, and about $688 million. A 10-year expenditure history. Again, you'll see a very large spike in 1920 for the budgeted amounts. But you'll look at 14-15, you'll see a jump in 14-15, and then you'll see another jump in 17-18. The jump in 14-15 is the first year of the parks levy. So that was the increase in the funds there, and you'll notice in 17-18 you'll see a little bit of another spike, and that's the hotel bond. So that's what those two are right there. 10-year FTE history, again, matching the back there, the 14-15, you'll see that spike there. That is really due to the, again, the Parks and Natural Areas Levy. About the same time, as Martha mentioned, we began converting temporary hours and budget to FTE, and so that is part of the increase also. And then we have our debt service obligations. So you'll notice the top little bar, the other debt, all other debt, that is actually made up of our full faith and credit right now, and that is the Expo, the remaining Expo bond, and the current MRC bond. The remainder in the for the first 3 years is, of course, natural areas and zoo. And then we sell the big gap, our big bunch, of course, is for the affordable housing bond, which will be sold on May 1st. Oh, and one, can you go back for just 1 second? You will not notice that the hotel bonds are on here. While we actually are responsible for the bonds, they are paid. It is not on, we don't budget for the payments, the budget, or but they do show up on the CAFR.
Tim. Can I ask, does this include the projections, for the forecast of potentially passing the Parks and Nature bond or transportation?
No,
this is just assuming what we have
for
right
current,
now.
Yep, okay. And what we will have effective night for 1920. So this does not include the parks and or any transportation bonds. Okay, and so this is the breakdown on the property tax levy. So this is actually when you act on May 2nd. This is really what you will be approving and setting the rate for. The top part is our general obligation bonds and what our projected, you'll see our projected payment for our housing bond is included already in here, and you will look down and see the jump in debt service from 1819 to 1920 of 24 cents. That is the levy for the full amount of the affordable housing bond. Again, those are projections. It will not go above that. Most probably we will end up long-term being below that 24 cents, but we are levying that 24 cents initially. Average homeowner of $200,000 assessed value, currently 95, and with the addition of the housing bond, we'll have about $142 a year in from Metro. Transient lodging taxes.
Do you need to not pass it, Councilor Gonzalez?
Okay. Yeah, I'm looking real quick at the affordable housing line, principal versus interest. Our general obligation debt, is that amortized, or why are we paying so much more interest before the principal? That might be a really basic question, but that jumped out to me.
Councilor Gonzalez, it is. It's a flat rate that we pay over a 20-year period, and similar to your mortgage, you pay more interest at the beginning and more principal at the end. So it's a very similar model. Okay, transient lodging taxes, those are taxes that go to the Merck venues, and you will notice, so if you could go back prior to the 15-16 year, it was when we had this, right after the Great Recession, we had this great boom where we probably averaged around 15% growth, maybe even a little higher. Then this first 3 years, 15-16 through 17-18, really kind of flattened out, became a little more normal. And then in 18-19, we are now, beginning in this year and next year, we are projecting continued growth in that. We will see the hotel actually open in the 19-20 year, so that hopefully will have some impact on this also. Really quickly on the venue summary, you'll notice the OCC is down 21%. Again, that is spending down the capital reserves with regards to the renovation project. You'll see an increase in Portland 5, and that is really due to the spending on the acoustical shell project and 13 weeks of Broadway. Those are the big drivers there. And then since Brian, Auditor Evans is not here, I will do his part really quickly. This is the office of the Metro Auditor. He really has not had an increase or asked for an increase in FTE or materials and services in prior years. The big driver for him, of course, is personal services. And his total budget will increase this year about 7.53%. And with that, without any question, I will move it back to Martha.
So as you move into your deliberations phase, I always like to pose some questions for you to sort of wrestle with as you do it. So my questions to you all are, the first one is the big one. Does this move Metro in the direction that you're hoping to move Metro and the region in? Second, does it strike a good balance between responding to program needs but also making sure that we are doing what I said earlier is being reliable for our region's residents so that we're not facing either significant fiscal ramp up or ramp down? Does it reflect what you told me you wanted to see in the budget? And does it continue to maintain confidence and trust with the people who live in our region? So I'm going to quickly go over what happens next, and then Tim and I would love to take your questions. Today is the day that we deliver the budget message, so that's the first date on your calendar. You are scheduled to hold a work session on April 16th, which is next Tuesday. You also tentatively have one on April 23rd if for any reason stuff comes up on Tuesday or you just don't get through all the work that you wanted to get through during your work session. On May 2nd, you'll be back here for a public hearing, and that is the date that we ask you to approve the budget. And as I say, that means setting the maximum property tax rate and the base appropriations. And then staff will quickly turn the budget around and send it off to TSCC on May 15th. You'll hold your hearing. The TSCC will hold their hearing. It's their hearing. You'll be part of it. On June 6th, final amendments will come back to you during that time period. For your consideration, you'll amend the budget the week of the 13th and then hopefully adopt the budget on June 20th. All right, before I do ask you questions, there's a bunch of people behind me I want to thank, and I think I got to say something about the dude next to me. If you were, oh, look at all these people. Would you guys just stand up? Would you guys just stand up? This is your finance team. These are the guys who actually not only work with Tim, but work with all the department directors and me to actually make sure that the budget comes together. Many of you hear me talk about the budget's a spending plan, which I think probably they don't think that I might take lightly, but the reality is I like spending plans that are based in reality, and these are the people behind me who make sure that we've got good numbers, we're working from great assumptions. They also take all my questions and have unpacked the contracted professional services line items in every single budget with me in excruciating detail, and I really appreciate all the work that they do. I also like to thank the lady to my left. Sarah Erskine hates to be thanked or acknowledged in any way, but as the process rolls forward, there's a whole lot of logistics, including the production of this document, that have to come together seamlessly to make it possible for us to do our work, and she really does that. Also behind me, Lisa Houghton, who is our budget manager. Oh, my God. The amount of work that she has to do to keep us all on track and the amount of bad jokes she has to listen to Tim and I tell during the process as we get increasingly chippy. It's really, truly amazing. And then last but not least, Mr. Collier, it's been a pleasure. And I am grateful to be with you for your last budget at Metro. All right. Now, with that, we would really like to entertain any questions you might have.
Questions? Councilor Craddock.
I have some.
The question I had regarding the venue summary, regarding the expo, it's down 6%. What is influencing that? And these aren't numbers. I can't give you a page. It's called venue summary.
We know the answer to that one. Do you want to go?
Yes. So, Councilor Craddock, Metro Councilors, we continue to spend ending fund balance inside of the expo. So the revenues versus the expenditure, or the expenditures outpace the revenues in every non-CERC year with regards to Expo, and it is projected to do that essentially until the debt is paid off in 2024, I believe. So in a CERC year, we essentially break even. In a non-CERC year, we eat into the ending fund balance.
Thank you.
Councilor Gonzalez.
Yeah, I have a few questions, actually. So there for the FTE for C2P2, that position is hired, right? Did we hire someone? Did I see that?
We are in recruitment for that position right now.
Okay, I thought we had filled it, and then we made an announcement, but I could be wrong.
No, it's not filled.
Okay. My next question is on the first 30 pages or so, we had a mention of one FTE for program specialist in performance management and $80,000 for that position. Is that the Lean or Metro by the Numbers program, or where does that pop up?
You'll remember Council blessed what we call the continuous improvement project, which has three elements: performance management, enterprise risk management, mm-hmm. and process improvement. And so we are going to support, we already have one and change folks working on that right now, but to support their work, we're going to hire another full-time equivalent and then two fellows to support that program. So those three new people are going to work on all three of those, all four of those people will work on all three of those initiatives. And if I could repeat that, I would, but I doubt it.
Yeah, excellent. Thank you. There was also a line item that mentioned that for community engagement, we are investing $20,000 in tablets. Is this a part of the less paper, more electronics, or?
Yes, it's actually in the council office to increase tablets to allow, I think, MPAC and JPAC to go to paperless packets.
Excellent. And I have a lot of questions. This is my last one, actually. This is my last one. How did you wake up today? No, I'm just kidding. What do you have for breakfast?
Oatmeal. Every day.
So I noticed that the general fund had a beginning balance of around $51 million, and also the PEZ fund had an initial balance of $51 million. There is some clarity to me around the general fund balance and kind of what goes into that, but for the PEZ fund, I mean, there are a few things mentioned: rate stabilization, future capital projects. But there's been a few conversations that we've had, you know, kind of up in the air about transfer stations, Metro South, West.
Right.
How does that get incorporated into the forecast of the budget?
So, you'll see in the CIP. Do they have a CIP? They have a CIP. Mm-hmm. You'll see in the capital improvement plan, there's some funds anticipated for the capital projects. For example, it's resolving the issues at Metro South, not only the potential Metro West transfer station, but those of you who've been around for a while know that Metro South was actually originally built to feed an incinerator that was never built, and so it was actually never really laid out for all the activities that happened there, and we have some pretty significant operational problems because of the interplay between commercial trucks, self-haul customers, and then folks visiting household hazardous waste. So we've planned for quite a long time to build a facility that would take self-haul recycling and household hazardous waste to another place. And so those funds will show up in the CIP, as will some initial work for a potential transfer station on the west side. So that is the down payment. The fund balance in solid waste is really the down payment on those future capital projects. And I will say Tim and I have worked really carefully with Solid Waste Department over the years to get them to have their capital budgets be a little bit more closely aligned with their ability to get the dollars out the door. And they've really vastly improved the relationship between, because for a while they were growing fund balance, improve their ability to deliver the projects that they budget and plan to do so that the fund balance doesn't continue to grow.
And I guess if I would add a little bit, as this large capital plan comes, the west side, potential west side transfer station, south expansion of central, et cetera, what will come before you will be using some of those funds, but you will also, again, probably have to do a financing of some sort, which would then be put into the regional system fee. So it will be kind of a balance on. So some of the funds will be what money we already have put aside, and some mm-hmm. of the funds will be on an ongoing per ton type repayment.
And so does the PEZ fund, did that kick in when some of the recycling markets, for example, went into shock, or is that usually the counties that put that money, or is it shared across the region? This is more a PEZ question, I guess.
Well, absurdly, when recycling markets sort of started to dry up and more of the material had to go to landfill, that was actually, unfortunately, good financially for Metro because we then collected...
You paid based on how much tonnage you had in the ground.
Yeah, stuff that's recycled doesn't get taxed, and stuff that goes to the landfill does get taxed, and so... Well, and gets system other fees and resume system fees. So unfortunately, Metro's general fund and our solid waste fund have benefited from having those markets shrink. Yeah. I'm not sure that answers your question, but it's
does.
One of those profound sadnesses that when we're failing to meet our policy goals, it's good for our bottom line.
Thank you, Martha.
And Tim. And Tim.
Councilor Lewis.
I have a question going back to our 10-year expenditure history, really looking at our 18-19 amended ending fund balance being the lowest in the 10-year history and then going into 19-20 with it being the highest. I guess, one, just asking, were we at that point where it was the lowest before we amended? I know we had an amendment early this year, but... Mm-hmm. Where is that swinginess coming from, and is that helping prepare us for the financial headwinds in the region?
Councilor Lewis, a couple of things. First, you'll notice in 17-18 where we have the actual number, that's significantly higher. We always budget that a lot of the ending fund will be spent, which it typically is actually not. The reason that we see that huge spike right there is because we're going to sell $653 million in bonds on May 1st, and so on July 1, you're going to have a giant carryover, probably $653 million, and that's where you would see that giant spike in beginning funds.
I suspect she's more interested in the dip than the spike, but I think your previous answer on it's because that's as amended, not actual.
Correct, and we always, again, are very conservative, so, and everybody believes that they're going to spend all the money they have, and that typically does not happen.
And I also would say that in some cases, fund balance staying flat is not always, I always tell people, like, not spending money is not always good news. Sometimes keeping fund balance high means we're not executing on capital, and so I would want to drill into more, but I agree with Tim that, first of all, that when we go to actual, it's not going to be like that. But I also would say that as we execute on OCC and the zoo and finish off the parks bond, you are going to see some of that dip, and we should not view that as bad. We should view that as good.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm as interested in where we're not spending money as where we are. So
yeah.
Thank you.
Yes.
I do have another just basic question on how – now, the property tax system works.
Yeah.
So under the average homeowner assessed / market value, what is the sample size? I mean, is it regional, county, city? You know, to what do you – is it statewide? And who determines that exactly?
Councilor Gonzalez, typically – so, for example, when we did the said for the housing bond what the average – homeowner was, which I believe was roughly $250,000. We have not updated this slide to the, and that was really the average of each of the three counties weighted for $250,000. So in this case, we said average, but it's really just figuring on the $200,000 number. Uh-huh. We would be closer on a regional average on an assessed value to that $251,000. I believe, and this is going back to 2016. It's roughly $219,000 in Multnomah County, $270,000+ in Washington, or in Clackamas, and $250,000 in Washington. So that's kind of how the average goes.
Assessed.
Assessed, sorry. Assessed
value. Yeah,
not
right.
The real market
not
value.
Market.
Assessed value, right.
Okay.
Any other questions? I will say we are here and we are in discussion around resolution number 19-4976 for the purpose of approving the FY 2019-20 budget, setting property tax levies, and transmitting the approved budget to the Multnomah County Tax Supervising and Conservation Commission. And to be clear, it looks like, oh, they've got a resolution to approve the budget in front of them. Well, we're not voting on this resolution at this time. We are beginning the discussion and having public discussion, and we will continue to have that discussion. We will be voting on this resolution on May 2nd. And we will now have a public hearing, and I would like to open the public hearing. I will call on anyone who would like to testify to come forward. I have no blue cards. Nevertheless, if there is anybody that would like to testify, please come forward. Seeing no one, I will close the public hearing. The Metro Council will hold a work session discussion of the budget on Tuesday, April 16th. An additional public hearing on the resolution number 19-4976 will be held on May 2nd, at which time the Council will consider approving the FY 2019-20 budget and sending it to the Tax Supervising and Conservation Commission for review. No further action on the budget will be taken at this meeting. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's a lot of work.
I know. Part one.
I will now call on COO Martha Bennett for any updates, perhaps three.
No, I have one, and then I'm going to suggest that Councillor Lewis give one to you. So if she doesn't, then I'll do it, but I'd rather have her do it. The main thing I wanted to let you know is we are in the public comment period on the draft framework for the Parks and Nature Bond. I want to thank those of you who are going out or who have gone out to city council meetings in the region in the month of April. I know that Councillor Lewis is going to Happy Valley, or maybe already has gone to Happy Valley.
I am going
to Happy Valley. And we've had some focused engagements, so thank you to those of you who showed up for the stakeholder meeting and also who showed up last week to the conservation meeting and the Indigenous Communities meeting. I guess the thing I would like to make sure you know is that we are about to launch a pretty extensive social media effort and also a survey for more generalized feedback. I think that gets launched either today or tomorrow, and it'll be open for like a week. So you may hear questions as you're out and about. If you have any specific questions, especially after you see it, please let either Heather Nelson-Kent or Laura Oppenheimer-Odoms know about what your questions are. Have your policy advisor let them know. Okay? Make sense? All right. The second thing that I suggest maybe I let Councillor Lewis talk about is I hope you all saw the news about Willamette Falls and about the Willamette Falls Trust's major announcement last evening. So I don't know if you want to take it from there.
Yes, thank you for the nice tee up, and I'd like to thank Councillor Gonzalez for braving the traffic that somebody should do something about to join me in the beautiful District 2. It's not as illustrious as 4, but we do our darndest, and we had quite the celebration last night because there is a $7 million gift coming for Willamette Falls Trust. Two foundations, two families, two individuals, really, moving forward on our shared vision of access to the waterfront and all of the historical conservation and environmental legacy that is there. And it's really exciting news for that private side to be coming forward with such enthusiasm.
Incredible, $7 million.
Yep.
Any other council updates?
I just want to thank Tyler, Karen, Paul, and Councillor Lewis, and anyone else that was at the Transportation is Liberation panel on Tuesday at Vestas. There was video taken and a lot of photos taken on a fancy camera, which I'm excited to see and share with you when it's available. It was a great panel, and just thank you, everyone, for supporting.
Councillor Lewis.
Sure, thank you. I have a couple of updates. One to follow up. Councillor Gonzalez did a fantastic job at Transportation as Liberation, and I played a minor role, but got to host a poster board station in which members of the public performed the same exercise we're asking our task force, actually kind of wrapped up asking our task force to do, which was fill in post-it notes. I'd like to make it easier to get from blank to blank. So we have captured just kind of some public attitude towards that kind of exercise and starting to envision corridors. So that was very exciting. Yesterday, in addition to joining the Willamette Falls Trust for their big celebration, I was able to attend a LOCS commission meeting. I am still a lady in waiting when it comes to the formal governor's appointment, but was able to be in the room and just wanted to report back that there is some very in-depth conversation about different funding opportunities for ongoing, so not the needed maintenance and updating, but actually ongoing funding mechanisms and the potential for raising revenue as the locks are operational in the future. So that commission's work is very important to making sure that the heritage area, the legacy project, locks all of that is going together to benefit both sides of the river and one step forward for the region. So that meeting went really well, and I know that there's a lot of conversations ahead.
Great. Any?
I appreciate Ernie reminding me on how I would have overlooked this. Yesterday, we learned from the Federal Transit Administration that we received the $87 million to build the Division Bus Rapid Transit. I'm thinking, I think this is a 4 or 5 year effort. I think it's, if anybody knows how long we've been working on this, and it really is quite remarkable to receive this in light of the challenges that we have in Washington, D.C. right now. So there were, I think, there were 5 cities in the region, in the U.S. that received these new funds. There's another 16 that are already have funding that they're getting additional funding for projects. So we feel really good about receiving this. So I want to say thank you to the staff. This is quite a massage that Metro staff and TriMet and, of course, City of Portland and City Gresham worked on to bring this project to a level where we thought we could be successful at funding. And so it was quite a massage of how you make that work. It's really been interesting to watch and follow the how challenging these projects are. And so it's quite an honor. And this will be our first bus rapid transit in Oregon, or in Portland, excuse me. We have had one in Eugene for a long time.
First of many?
First of many, yes.
Any other updates? I have one update about MPAC. MPAC met last night. Good news. Multnomah County Commissioner Sushila Jayapal was elected as the vice chair for MPAC and will, of course, become chair next year, and really appreciate her stepping up, really just starting to even attend these meetings and start in on the commission, and her willingness to sort of jump right in is much appreciated. We discussed 2 topics. One was the census and really the importance of the census to our region and proposed changes at the federal administration level to ask about citizenship has created for many a fear of participating in the census. And what that does is reduce the numbers of folks who are counted in our region. Each person that goes uncounted is a loss of $169 per year. So over a 10-year period between census, that's $1,690 per person uncounted. So it's very important that we make sure everybody gets counted for those resources. And we're also in line for a additional congressional seat in Oregon. So very important issue. Folks were very engaged and learned how they can participate in moving that forward. And helping with our work at Metro, and certainly was much appreciated that Metro is stepping up to support that effort. We also discussed the open space bond measure, and folks received a presentation for that. Some had to go a little bit early for Willamette Falls celebration, which was there were still a good number of folks that stayed and participated in the open space bond measure discussion. There was interest in providing input, and we encourage folks to continue to do that. MPAC did not take a position on it, but I think was well informed after this discussion. There were a lot of questions about some of our kind of racial equity strategies and leading with race strategies that I think were around really clarifying what it meant, but I think we're intended to really just understand how that will move forward, and I think there was certainly a lot of support for the work. This concludes my part. Was there anything to add?
No. Thank you to the Parks and Nature staff for rephrasing large-scale community vision projects. Brilliant.
Yes.
Yeah. Urban transformation was renamed to large scale.
There were questions about that.
Yeah.
And I think enthusiasm when folks heard the types of projects that would be part of it, when they heard that Willamette Falls would be a kind of project, that Albina Vision would be the type of project that would be in there, there was a lot of head nodding and enthusiasm. Hearing no other reports, I hereby adjourn our council meeting. The council meeting is adjourned, and the next regular council meeting is scheduled for Thursday, April 25th at 2 p.m. at the Metro Regional Center Council Chambers.